Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Intelligence Matters ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This is Intelligence Matters with former acting director of the CIA, Michael Morell. Brought to you by Lockheed Martin. Your mission is ours.
Ambassador Bill Roebuck is the executive vice president of the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. He recently served as the deputy special envoy to the Global Coalition to Defeat ISIS and as senior advisor to the special representative for Syria engagement, Ambassador James Jeffrey. Ambassador Roebuck had a long career in the Foreign Service, including serving as U.S. Ambassador to Bahrain from 2015 to 2017. Ambassador Roebuck just joined me to talk about all things Syria. We'll be right back with that discussion after a word from our sponsor. I'm Michael Morell, and this is Intelligence Matters.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Mr. Ambassador, welcome to Intelligence Matters. It is great to have you on the show.
Thank you, Mike. I'm delighted to be here.
So as you know, we're going to dig into Syria and ISIS, but I first want to ask a couple of questions about your career, if that's okay. And I'd love to start by asking you, what got you interested in the world, in foreign policy, and in the Foreign Service?
Thank you for the question to sort of open things up, Mike. I got interested in international relations in the world, I think, years ago, coming out of undergraduate school. I joined the Peace Corps, motivated primarily by a desire to travel and some idealism, wanting to volunteer and improve things. And as I was overseas as a volunteer, a whole world sort of opened up for me. I was in Africa in Cote d'Ivoire, but also learned a lot about the Middle East from friends who were there working, who were from the Middle East, and eventually went to the Middle East and worked as a teacher. And by a circuitous route, law school, et cetera, I ended up in the Foreign Service and became a diplomat for the U.S. Department of State, and have built my career ever since, primarily in the Middle East. So that's really how I got into the whole business.
So you're a little bit unusual in that you've got that law school piece in there. Did you find that helpful during your Foreign Service career?
It was very helpful. I studied, I mean, in law school, you get the whole array of courses, and particularly in first year, everybody takes the same basic set. But I focused in my latter 2 years on international law and got a lot of exposure to just international public law, private international private, more business transaction type law, international human rights. And it was very useful as a framework coming into the Foreign Service. In the end, you sort of have to get your hands dirty, so to speak, with experience. You got to learn how diplomacy is made, how visas are issued. That's how you sort of break into the Foreign Service, doing immigration and visa work. But the studies were very useful as a background.
So you've joined the Foreign Service, you're at the State Department. Can you give us a sense of the trajectory of your career, where you served, where you spent time, the kind of issues you were involved in? Just kind of a rough sketch would be fantastic.
Sure. So I came into the Foreign Service as a young, what we called back then, junior officer. I was assigned to be a consular officer in Jamaica, basically like a lot of the young officers who came in back then in the early 90s, right out of the chute. My primary focus was on visa issuance and helping American citizens who were in trouble. And then I knew I wanted to work my way to the Middle East. That was my entrance. So my second tour was in Jerusalem, where I did mostly political reporting work in the West Bank, and did various things, keep an eye on how settlements were developing, Palestinian political politics, and those types of issues. And from there on, I sort of went from one post to another in the Middle East, because that was my interest. I did Gaza political politics for several years, working out of the embassy in Tel Aviv, but commuting to Gaza several days a week. I was in Baghdad. I was the political chief for our U.S. embassy in Damascus back in 2004 until 2007. And was chargé d'affaires, essentially acting ambassador in Libya, in Tripoli, for 6-7 months, and did some other stints out there of shorter periods in 2013. And then I was our ambassador to Bahrain in the Arabian Gulf area from 2014 to 2017. So sort of served all over the Middle East and handled a variety of issues, a lot of maintenance of bilateral relations with these countries, cooperation on counterterrorism, particularly as I rose up in the latter stages. I did a lot of commercial advocacy for U.S. companies in trying to build U.S. trade relations and investment in the Gulf, for example. So a varied set of assignments.
Okay, Bill, Syria and ISIS. So your last job in the department was as the deputy special envoy to the coalition to defeat ISIS. And before we get to that fascinating job, perhaps we can start with a bit of history here for my listeners. Can you walk us through, sort of from a big picture perspective, the period from the start of the civil war in Syria to when you walk into that last job of yours?
Sure. I'll give you a very thumbnail sketch. So protests, up until the Arab Spring in Syria, Syria was a police state. It had been run by the Assad family. Hafez Assad, the father, passed away. The son was the president in the late part of the first 2000s. And then the Arab Spring broke out. Over time, peaceful demonstrations were replaced by violent outbreaks. The Assad regime, I think, wanted that to happen and did not allow any space for peaceful protests. So over the course of years, from late 2011 and 12, through really the years up until I went out there, there was armed insurgent groups of varying levels of Islamist complexion who were fighting against the Assad regime, being armed by different external players. The Russians entered the conflict in, I believe, 2016, somewhere along in there, and essentially put the conflict on a much more favorable footing for the regime. And they have essentially prevailed, I would say, militarily, but they can't control the whole country. So there are large swaths of Syria now that are not under the Syrian government, the Syrian regime's control. And that's sort of where we are. I think the military situation is stalemated, but we haven't been able to move into a real full peace process or any sort of political solution for the future of Syria. Although it's not without trying, the UN's been heavily involved, and we've been heavily involved with UN Security Council Resolution 2254 and a Geneva process, but it just hasn't gotten a lot of traction.
So, Bill, great arc of history on the Syria political front. Can you do the same thing with regard to ISIS?
Sure. So ISIS got its start in Iraq. It developed out of some predecessor organizations that developed in the wake of the war that occurred in Iraq and all that set of developments that occurred in 2003 until 2012 time frame. By 2014, ISIS had exploded into Iraq and Syria, controlled large swaths of territory in both countries. At one point, I think it had control of about 40,000 square miles. It took over large cities in both countries, Mosul in Iraq and other cities, Raqqa in northern Syria, and really controlled the northern band of both countries. It was able to establish an external plotting platform to plot terror attacks in Europe and other capitals, and represented a serious security and strategic threat to the United States and Europe and to other countries in the world. President Obama wanted to take it on, but wanted to do it in a way that involved others. It wasn't just a U.S. government venture. So he organized or saw to the organization of this international or global coalition against ISIS. And it has evolved into an organization with 83 members, mostly states, about 79 countries and a few other organizations, and has proven remarkably nimble and effective at fighting ISIS. And I think we can say that, you know, without using the word defeat, I think we can say that with the military piece of the global coalition over the last few years, we have dealt a catastrophic military set of setbacks to ISIS, to their leadership, to their organization, and to their ability to plan terror attacks. They're still around in remote areas of Iraq and Syria. It still requires attention and pretty constant CT work, but it's under control now.
So, Bill, let me ask you kind of two questions about this big swath of time that we just talked about. One's about Syrian politics and the other's about the fight against ISIS. The question about Syrian politics is as you know, there's a debate about whether the United States should have done more in the early months of the civil war to support the opposition And there's some people who say, yes, we should have done more. And there's some people who say, no, you know, we needed to be careful for all sorts of reasons. Where do you fall in that debate?
It's in some ways, and I mean, I will answer the question. I think in some ways it's an unanswerable question. I think we, as we always do in politics, war, and diplomacy, we're always fighting the last war. I think the framework of decision makers and policymakers as we headed into the Arab Spring was decisively shaped by what had happened in the previous decade in Iraq, where we did intervene decisively and for very good reasons, many of them, but maybe without a fundamental set of understandings about the country and the way it fit into the region, we broke itself. We broke the country really from its regional moorings, and we've been dealing with those consequences ever since. So, I think policymakers, and I would include myself in that, were pretty cautious about getting involved in Syria in a way where the United States would essentially own the conflict. There was a very dangerous brew of jihadi elements in the country. A direct U.S. intervention could have I don't think there's any question we could have pushed aside the Assad regime over time. But then you own the country, and your very presence, your very efforts exacerbate what is a terrorist threat and a terror insurgency. So I would have urged extreme caution. I probably would have, in a few precise instances, urged a more robust response to try to create some strategic deterrence and uncertainty, maybe. But I would not have urged a full U.S. Intervention. I also was heavily involved in the Libya policies and we saw what happened there. So there were several cautionary tales that were persuading people not to get too rapidly involved.
Bill, the second question I think is a pretty easy one. Were there any major differences in how the Trump administration fought the war against ISIS versus how the Obama administration did? Or is it pretty much the same?
It was very similar. I think at the margins, they may have eased up some of the restrictions about particular actions that we took. But overall, I would say it was very similar. I mean, the U.S. military composition that was out there was the same. I mean, there were people rotating in over time, but the basic structure, organization, the way we prosecuted the war against ISIS militarily and with the global coalition was essentially the same. It was very similar. There was a civilian piece to it that people like Brett McGurk and Ambassador Jim Jeffrey had charge of. And then there was the military prosecution of the war, which was the U.S. military had the lead on it, but with a lot of partners in the global coalition who contributed troops or either military capabilities.
Okay, great. So now you're in that last job. So you're the deputy envoy. What's your objective? What are you supposed to accomplish? Where did you spend most of your time? Can you tell us a little bit about the job?
Sure. So I had essentially a two-pronged job as deputy special envoy. Some of it was Washington-based and with travel to regional capitals, helping Ambassador Jeffrey to manage that global coalition. We had different lines of effort, whether it was countering ISIS's ideology or their money financing, terror financing activities, making sure we were drumming up enough support for stabilization activities and assistance in Iraq and Syria, those types of things. And I did that sort of, that was my day job when I was back in Washington. I was in Washington probably about 30% of the time over those 2.5 years. And then that big 70% of my time I was out in Syria. And I was embedded with U.S. Special Forces in a couple of remote bases. My primary function was to ensure that we had good liaison with the Syrian Democratic Forces, our local partners, and in particular with the leadership. I was with them regularly, sometimes every day. I would meet, depending on if we were in a crisis situation, I might meet with General Mazlum and his leadership a couple times a day. So I ensured that we had that liaison. I got out a lot to sort of show the flag and create a sense that the U.S. had a presence there diplomatically. I visited different cities, small communities, to check on local administration, to check on how the assistance that we were providing and others were providing was being delivered, and just do classic political reporting and showing the flag. I did a lot of that also. And the third function I would say is I was a liaison with our U.S. military to make sure that we were all knitted up, and other capabilities to make sure that we were all knitted up together and working from the same sheet of music.
We're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsor. Then we'll be right back with more of our discussion with Ambassador Robach.
We all have busy lives these days, and we don't want to waste a day recovering after a night out. That's why ZBiotics is the answer we've all been looking for. Their probiotic was invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking. Here's how it works. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the gut. It's this byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for your rough next day. Pre-alcohol produces an enzyme to break this byproduct down. This is a proactive solution that wards off feeling miserable the next day instead of a reactive approach like drinking electrolytes or eating greasy food. Enhance your mornings with ZBiotics. Go to ZBiotics.com/CBS to get 15% off your first order when you use code CBS at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. Remember to head to ZBiotics.com/CBS and use the code CBS at checkout for 15% off. Thank you, ZBiotics, for sponsoring this episode and our good times.
So, Bill, in terms of the coalition in the fight against ISIS, who were the key players? Who were the most significant contributors to the fight? How do you think about that?
Obviously, the United States provided the leadership at the diplomatic level at all, and also at the military level. I think nobody would dispute that. I mean, we were the dominant military player in both Iraq and Syria, but we did have key allies. Of course, on the European side, the British, the French, the Italians, the Germans were all very important players with us. And we had lots of other key partners. Some of our friends in the Gulf, the Saudis, the Emiratis, were active members of the coalition and were very helpful also in helping us when our funding for stabilization dried up, when President Trump froze it in 2018. A few of our Gulf partners and a few of our European partners stepped in and provided critical funding on the stabilization assistance side too. So I'd say those were the key players that worked with us and helped us.
And what about the Kurds? Can you talk about the Kurds and their importance?
The Kurds had organized with Arab elements in northeastern Syria a local organization, the Syrian Democratic Forces, that we relied on, and it was absolutely critical to defeating ISIS. This was a group that, as I said, had both Kurdish and Arab elements. But some of the critical leadership was definitely, Kurdish that came out of, previous organizations. They were highly motivated. They were able to take casualties. They were quite well disciplined in a military sense. They fought well. The U.S. Special Forces folks that I spoke to repeatedly indicated that they were the best group like that they had trained and equipped in their experience doing this over several decades. So their contribution to the fight against ISIS was absolutely essential. We worked with them. We provided training and equipping and some partnered type operations, but they were the backbone, and they were the backbone for the fighting. They were also the backbone for our security, providing our security so that we could function over there. And then they were the backbone for the security for the region of the whole Northeast, making sure cities were secure with police forces, and making sure that there was local administration to ensure that the humanitarian situation was addressed and people could move about with their daily lives. So they were, in answer to your question, shorthand, they were absolutely essential, and they were great partners.
So I've heard some people say that we could not have done the damage to ISIS that you talked about earlier. We could not have taken away the caliphate without them. Do you think that's fair?
I do. I think that's absolutely accurate. I mean, we had overwhelming air power and other assets, but to actually dig in and dig out a heavily embedded force like that that's hiding among the local population, you have to have a fighting force on the ground. And they were that force in Syria. They had good intelligence. They worked seamlessly with our military on the capabilities that we could provide. And over time, we slowly took back all that territory in Syria, just as we had done working with Iraqi military forces in Iraq. And it was not easy. But on the other hand, they did most of the fighting on the ground. They absorbed the casualties. Very few American lives were lost in that conflict while we were over there. You're talking over a period of a couple of years, I think maybe a dozen or so U.S. Elements were lost their lives. And a lot of those were not in direct combat. It was just related to the inevitable casualties you sometimes suffer in a combat situation.
Bill, what motivated the Kurds to fight with us? Why was this so important to them?
That's also a very good question. I mean, part of it was a hatred of ISIS, a fear of ISIS. ISIS had attacked some of their cities, and they fought with incredible bravery and tenacity to get ISIS out and to save their population in some of these cities along the northern border of Syria. So that was clearly a motivation. I think they wanted, coming out of that partnership with us against ISIS, they wanted, I think, to build on the relationship with the United States. I think they wanted legitimacy to a certain degree for some of their political demands and some of their demands as a people in terms of recognizing their cultural identity and language and things like that. I think that was also a more general motivation for. But they certainly wanted to maintain the relationship with the United States. And I think they continue to see us as an indispensable partner and as somebody that, as long as we're out there and are, focused with them on ISIS and partnering with them, they benefit from it in direct and in indirect ways. And then the final thing I'd say is that, just to be honest, I don't think they had a lot of options. And it was a very difficult situation. There was a war going on, and we were, an option that provided some advantages for them. And there were some overlapping interests involved. So they pursued the relationship, and it's been a relationship that has been beneficial for both sides.
So Bill, walk us through what happens when President Trump announces that we're pulling out of Syria and allowing the Turks to invade northern Syria. Where were you when you heard that? Did you know it was coming? Did the Kurds know it was coming? Tell us what happened.
So I was in northeastern Syria at the time, moving back and forth between some remote U.S. Special Forces bases where we were co-located with some of our local partners' forces in the Syrian Democratic Forces, what we call the SDF. We did not know it was coming. I would say, to put it fairly, we were blindsided by it. It created an incredibly stressful set of pressures on our relationship with the SDF. It threatened the coalition that we had built with them to fight ISIS, and it threatened to destabilize the entire northeastern part of Syria. It was a very difficult situation to deal with. I had some incredibly tough meetings with General Mazloum when I had to sort of bear the brunt of his disappointment and anger that at this sudden shift in policy that threatened his forces with, destruction, but also threatened a humanitarian catastrophe, basically, for Kurdish people if it got out of control. And I wasn't the only one. Ambassador Jeffrey also had some tough meetings with General Mazloum. And he was feeling understandably betrayed, I think, and disappointed. In the end, not to belabor it too much, we were able to turn it around. We, with some difficult decision-making and some interventions back in Washington, President reversed course a little bit, and we managed to salvage our presence in about half of the northeast of Syria. We salvaged the relationship with the SDF, and we have managed to continue the fight against ISIS. But it was a very tough period that you refer to.
Do you have any idea, or if you don't know, any guesses as to what might have happened in that phone call between President Erdogan of Turkey and President Trump, and what case President Erdogan might have made that President Trump found so compelling?
I don't know. I don't have special information about what entailed the conversation. I think President Trump was not up until that point was not a really convinced that it made sense for us to be in Syria. So he wasn't really, it wasn't a hard case for somebody to make. And of course, President Erdogan knows that area like the back of his hand. They've been involved in those areas for, it's their backyard. And, it wasn't something President Trump was familiar with. I mean, he wasn't convinced it was something we needed to do. I think once he took the decision and he got the blowback and some people that he, listened to carefully, including Senator Lindsey Graham and others, I think he became more persuaded of the importance of our role there. But I think at the time of the conversation, he wasn't very persuaded that it was an important thing. So maybe it wasn't that difficult to be talked out of it.
Bill, do you think there will be any long-term consequences from that situation, or do you think that we've moved beyond it and don't need to worry about long-term consequences? How do you think about that?
You mean the decision about the Turkish incursion?
Yes.
I think we've moved beyond it. I mean, it's been very difficult for the Kurdish population to absorb, because cities with large Kurdish populations like Tel Abyad, like Ras Al Ain, have basically been emptied of the Kurds. So there's been some, you know, some ethnic cleansing, whatever you want to call it. There's been some severe disruption in human terms and in social terms there that is going to take decades to repair. I think on the military side and the political side, it's maybe a more manageable situation, but it just makes the overall situation, which is already extremely complicated and complex, even more so. Not clear to me what Turkey wants to do with that enclave or other enclaves that it's created in northern Syria. And the whole problem of Syria, all the various stakeholders who are involved in it have competing agendas. And that's an example of one agenda, competing agenda. It's just very difficult to see going forward how you resolve all those competing agendas and find a political solution that stabilizes Syria.
So looking forward, Bill, what do you think our policy should be with regard to Syrian politics on the one hand and keeping an eye on ISIS on the other? What do you think the U.S. should be doing?
I think the new administration needs to, first of all, assess very carefully what our objectives should be out there. We had a set of objectives for the last three or four years, you know, defeat ISIS, try to implement a political solution for Syria under UN Security Council Resolution 2254, stop the use of weapons of mass destruction, get the Iranians out, and address the humanitarian suffering. I think the new administration with the Biden team needs to look at those objectives and evaluate carefully if we have the leverage. Do we have the political leverage to accomplish that? And what are those leverage, sources of leverage that we have? We do have a small military presence. We've got sanctions against the regime that give us some leverage. We have this de-ISIS coalition. We have some blocking leverage in terms of normalization of our diplomatic relations and reconstruction assistance. So we do have some leverage, but I do wonder if we have enough leverage to accomplish those things. But I think the new Biden team needs to do an assessment. For now, what we're doing out there, I think in the short term, can continue its sustainable. U.S. military presence is stable. The ISIS goal, the defeat ISIS goal is sustainable. So they have a window to do this reassessment, but I think they do need to look carefully at what has happened and assess if we have the necessary political leverage to achieve what we've been trying to achieve. I'm not sure we do, but I think that's for the new team to look at. The other two things need to be done very quickly. One is consult closely with key allies who have been there with us on the stabilization assistance side, the military side, and then consult with the Syrian people and determine as best we can what they want. Part of the problem is they're very divided.
Bill, thank you very much for joining us. This has been terrific. And thank you for your service to the State Department and to our country over a very long and illustrious career. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you very much for having me on your show.
You're welcome. That was Ambassador Bill Roebuck. I'm Michael Morrell. Please join us next week for another episode of Intelligence Matters.
Intelligence Matters is sponsored by Lockheed Martin. Your mission is ours. This show is produced by Olivia Gassis, Jamie Benson, Jake Rosen, Paulina Smolinski, and Ariana Freeman. For more from this week's show, visit cbsnews.com. Intelligence Matters is a production of CBS Audio.
I'm CBS News correspondent Major Garrett, host of the podcast Agent of Betrayal, The Double Life of Robert Hansen. During the Cold War, FBI agent Robert Hansen traded classified secrets to the Kremlin in exchange for cash and jewels. In the podcast, you'll hear from Hansen's closest friends, family members, victims, and colleagues for the most comprehensive telling of who Robert Hansen really was. Binge the entire series now. Agent of Betrayal, The Double Life of Robert Hansen is available on the Wondery app, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.